What would you little maniacs like to do first?
They bought it. Hello, may I help you?
Ha!
You like your panties?
Eat my shorts.
You just bought yourself another Saturday, mister. We'll keep going. You want another one? Say the word. Just say the word. Instead of going to prison, you'll come here.
Bueller?
By the way, why are we wearing bras on our heads?
I don't trust this kid any further than I can throw him.
How long have you been a lesbian?
His name is Blaine?
Bueller?
Claire.
Claire? Bueller?
Well, Brian's trying to tell me that in addition to the number of girls in the Niagara Falls area, that presently you and he are riding the hobby horse.
Pardon my French, but you're an asshole.
Shut up, Pee-wee.
She's gotten her boobies.
Oh. Boy, I wouldn't give a squirt of piss for your ass right now.
The girl was, is, and will always be nada.
This is 1987. Did you know that a girl can be whatever she wants to be?
You get along with your parents?
I mean, I don't think either one of them gives a shit about me.
You don't know what the hell you're talking about!
You know what the hell I'm talking about! You just never listen to me! You only hear what you want!
Yeah, I ain't gotta see a doctor, because that condition of yours can get a lot worse.
Does Barry Manilow know that you raid his wardrobe?
Do you have any idea how disrespectful that is?
What do you care what I think anyway? I could disappear forever and it wouldn't make any difference. I may as well not even exist at this school.
Why, you're only 18 years old, for Christ's sake.
Then I'm 19, then I'm 20. When does my life belong to me?
That is why I have got to catch him this time. To show these kids that the example he sets is a first-class ticket to nowhere.
I'd recommend you keep your eyes and your mind off my property.
Hey, how come Andrew gets to get up? If he gets up, we'll all get up. It'll be anarchy.
If you say Ferris Bueller, you lose a testicle.
Bueller? 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 Bueller?
He's sick.
Rummy!
The old man grabbed me and said, hey, smoke up, Johnny!
Changed my mind. I want you out in front of the school, Winter. I'd like to have a few words with you, by God.
Ferris Bueller, you're my hero.
When you go, your heart dies.
Who cares?
I care.
Life moves pretty fast.
You see us as you want to see us. Brain. An athlete.
Basket case. A princess.
And a criminal. Sincerely yours. The Breakfast Club.
Yes, it's the John Hughes special. We're going to talk about six John Hughes films. I'm going to be joined by various hosts as we go along when we talk about 16 Candles, The Breakfast Club, The Weird Science, Pretty in Pink, Some Kind of Wonderful, and
Ferris
I missed
Bueller.
One. Ferris Bueller. How the hell did I forget Ferris Bueller's day off? Yeah, and somewhere along the line, Ferris Bueller. But we're going to start with 16 Candles, and joining me for that is Suzanne King.
Hi, Stephen.
What did you think of that introduction?
Well, what I thought was, fucking hell, I know a lot of those quotes.
You know, when I was putting that together, first of all, that took fucking ages to edit that together. But when I was putting that together, I literally grabbed as many memorable quotes from each film as I could, as sound bites, put them all into one file so I could just, like, take out what I needed. And without any music, with literally just the quotes running next to each other, it was like 6 minutes long.
Very quotable films.
Yeah,
very,
so that's why the intro is 3 minutes long, you know, just to get you in the mood, remind you of all the teenage angst.
What would be quite interesting is I bet everybody, well not a bit, I bet a lot of people who've listened to that have been like, yeah, I remember that quote, and oh yeah, that's from 16 Candles, oh yeah, yeah, that was for the Ferris Bueller, that was from Breakfast Club. I bet loads of people remember those quotes, because they're really, really memorable.
Yep, absolutely. Well, you know, that's a tribute to John Hughes as a writer. He knew his stuff.
He did know his stuff.
Yeah.
When it came to teenage angst.
Absolutely, and that was only part of his career, because he did a lot of National Lampoon stuff before this.
And he did Home Alone.
Yeah, and then he went on to do, you know, Uncle Buck, and then Home Alone, and then all the Home Alone rip at Home Alone 2, and then all the films after that, where it was basically just people getting hurt. Baby's Day Out, Dennis the Menace, Flubber, 101 Dalmatians. He wrote all those screenplays with, you know, henchmen getting beaten up and falling over and shit, and you're just like, oh my god.
Clearly he likes a good
Didn't really
film.
Get a lot of that back in these days.
No, yeah. He was dealing with his own personal shit, back in yeah. the...
Well, he was our age. He was in his, like, 30s.
I'm not 30.
Aren't you?
Yeah. You can edit that back.
In his mid-30s when he was making these films. So, 16 Candles. This is... I actually saw this one last out of all of them.
Okay.
Because it just wasn't so readily available on video at the time. But I eventually got it. And I was really disappointed with it.
Really?
Well, on the back of the cover, it said something like... It's... Because it's Molly Ringwald is in the lead role.
Yeah.
It's her birthday, her 16th birthday, and no one remembers.
Yes.
And I was like, oh, that sounds like a great John Hughes film. It's going to be, you know, throughout the whole day, people are not going to know it's her birthday. She's not going to drop the penny, but she's going to get really fed up and upset about it all. And in the end, everyone will either remember or it'll all will have been a trick on, you know, to give her a big birthday bash at the end and she'll be all happy.
Well, John Hughes...
And that's not the plot at all.
John Hughes films don't go like that. It's not like suddenly, or the parents suddenly remember and are like, oh, but it was all a trick, here's your car.
Yeah, but you can say, like...
That's not what life's like.
Yeah, but you can kind of sum up the plots in one line. Breakfast Club, kids in detention.
Yeah.
Ferris Bueller's Day Off, kid bunks off school.
Yeah. Sum up Sunken and the Wonderful in one line.
So you can see why I thought it...
Sum up Pretty in Pink in one line, go.
Poor girl falls for rich guy.
Okay. Sunken and the Wonderful.
Poor guy, false rich girl.
It's the same film.
And then Weird Science is the exception to the rule, you know.
Guys create
woman.
Yeah. Well, no, 16 Candles, they forget her birthday.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's a bit more complicated than that.
Well, that's the life of a teenage girl. Yeah. I discover. It's
and so, we've got Anthony Michael Hall in there as well,
uh-huh.
playing Farmer.
He's really young.
I know. He's like ultra skinny.
Well,
But he's not even playing like the nerdy character. He's kind of like the mouthy cool kid at school,
he's not
sort of.
Cool. He's like a freshman, and trying he's a bit of a nerd. He's trying to be cool, but he's a bit of a embarrassment. Bless him.
And he's got her underpants.
Oh, but no, that's because he says to her, "Please, can I have your underpants?" And she gives them to him, which, frankly, no 16-year-old girl I know would ever help out a geek like that. But you know, whatevs.
Yeah, yeah, that's a bit bizarre. So, how did you come across this one then?
I don't remember. It's just one of those films that you kind of have watched at some point in your youth that's not as good as Ferris Bueller, but it's kind of in the same vein as Ferris Bueller and The Breakfast Club and Some Kind of Wonderful and Pretty in Pink. Because obviously it's by the same fella. But,
yeah.
You know, and it's not as memorable as any of those films, and it's not as quotable as any of those films.
Do you recognise the guy that she fancies?
No.
Who, I must say, is a bit of a dick.
Yes.
He's not exactly...
He's a bit of a dick because, oh, here's my girlfriend. She's really, really drunk. Oh, hello, geek guy. Why don't you take her home and pretend that you're me and maybe date rape her? No, that's fine. Sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah, that creepy. Made me not like him. Totally creepy. That whole subplot involving the other girlfriend.
But...
Anyway.
I remember when Shane and I talked about Vamp, and we were talking about a guy that was in that was clearly trying to channel Matt Dillon. This guy's trying to do the same thing.
But before Matt Dillon was Matt Dillon?
No, Matt Dillon was kind of becoming Matt Dillon. He did The Outsiders this year.
Oh, okay.
So Matt Dillon was certainly becoming... But there must have been a bunch of them about at the same time.
All at the same time.
All trying to be Matt Dillon. And Matt Dillon was like, well, obviously there's only room for one of me, so you guys going to have to...
Me.
You guys going to have to go work in TV. this guy, I did see in one other film, and that was Mermaids. He's the guy that Winona Ryder fancies in that.
Oh, yes, that is Winona Ryder. Oh, my God, I love Mermaids. Anyway.
Back on the 16 Candles.
Yeah, it's just not as good as the rest of the John Hughes films.
John Cusack and Joan Cusack.
Yes, oh, my God, I completely forgot. And I was like, oh, my God, there's Joan Cusack. Where's John Cusack? Oh, there he is, of course, because they're always in films together.
Really? Yeah, well, you know, it's like to work with each other,
yeah. It's like, oh, you give me a job,
has
John
Cusack ever had a Oscar nomination? Because she's had two. Can you tell me the two films that she was nominated for an Oscar for?
No, I can't. What are they?
Working Girl.
Oh, that's a great film.
Did she win that? She was nominated at the very least. She might have won that.
Got a head.
And the other one, which does have Matt Dillon in it, is, what was it called? In and Out?
With Kevin Costner.
No, Kevin Kline. It's the one when he's the teacher and he's gay. He comes out and she's the wife.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
He's not really gay, though, is he?
The character turns out to be, yes.
Oh, he does.
And that gets brought to his attention when he gets snogged by Tom Selleck, who plays a reporter.
I mean, who wouldn't go gay for Tom Selleck?
Yeah, Tom Selleck, minus the mustache.
Oh, I like him with the mustache.
Yeah.
Anyway, we digress. We've totally
digressed.
We do
digress.
So,
this was John Hughes's, like we said, first teenage comedy. I think it was the first one we directed? I think it might be.
Okay, well, that would
explain. Yes, and then The Breakfast Club followed the next year. made these in quick succession.
Yeah.
But yeah, like I said, I saw this film that one time, and I was like, oh my god, what the hell is this about? Although I was amused by the fact that she gets fondled by her own grandmother.
Yeah. What is quite good about this film, although it's not the finest John Hughes film by a long stretch, is that even though he's a man in his 30s, he absolutely accurately sums up what it's like to be a 16-year-old girl. And to fancy a boy that is, like, completely out of your league,
yeah,
and, like, completely just, like, stare at him and just be like, oh, I love you so much. And then when he talks to you, be so completely flabbergasted that A, he knows you exist, and B, that he's talking to you, that you just run away.
Yeah. And then the guy doesn't talk to you again.
Exactly.
Because they're like, well, was there a problem?
But it's because it's just like, I can't believe he just talked to me, oh my god, run! And he just absolutely captured that perfect, that is absolutely perfect what it's like to be a 16-year-old girl.
Fair enough.
Seriously,
yeah.
That is exactly what it's like. Who knows I exist?
That aside, is the plot worth a damn? Because her sister's getting married and there's all that hassle going on.
Whatevs.
Yeah,
it's not the fact that her sister's getting married is the reason that everyone forgets that it's her 16th birthday, because her sister is getting married on the same day as her 16th.
And what's
birthday?
The deal with that fucking exchange student that they got in the house?
I don't know, but that's slightly racist.
That kid, he was in Vamp that I mentioned earlier on, playing the character called Duncan.
Okay, was he like a racial stereotype in that as well?
No, not really. No.
Okay.
No, no.
He really was in this film.
No, he was the rich dorky kid in that one. Yeah, but
there's some serious stereotypes in this film. It's all right. I wouldn't rush out. If you can only see one John Hughes film, I wouldn't make it this one.
But a lot of people do go on about this film.
I think,
and certainly back then, they were like, "Yay, that's the best one. That's the great one." And when I just eventually got to it, I was like, "Nah, that's got nothing on The Breakfast Club, and it's got nothing on Ferris Bueller."
It's not as funny as Ferris Bueller. It's not as funny as Breakfast Club. It's not as funny as fucking Weird Science, and. It's not as funny as Pretty in Pink.
It might be funnier than Pretty in Pink, but I think Pretty in Pink has better characters.
And a more heart. I think Pretty in Pink's got more heart.
Yeah, but I'll talk about Pretty in Pink when I get to it. This one had a lot more of the wacky sensibility that he brought along from his National Lampoon days.
Yeah.
You look at things like Animal House, and even the original Vacation film, also with Anthony Michael Hall. There was a lot more zaniness going on, a lot more... I don't want to say sketches, but you get a lot of stuff going on with a lot of different characters and a lot of things going on in the course of a short space of time.
What was
all modelled round, you know, her trying to get this dude.
But I think the reason that it has achieved the place it has in a lot of people's hearts is because of that central truth of this is what it's like to be a 16-year-old girl. And even the bit where she talks to her dad and her dad says to her, you know, what's the matter, pumpkin? And she's like, you know, there's this boy and I really like him. And then, you know, he's like, oh, well, never mind, dear. Pat, pat, pat. And it's,
talk to your mother.
Yeah, talk to your mother. Kind of is. Yeah, I mean, that there's a central truth to that whole relationship. And even the whole family dynamic, there is an essential truth to that, because the older sister is stomping around and wanting her attention because it's her wedding day. And
it's also her period.
And she's on her period. And, you know, the younger children, that the younger brother is a bit of a shit and he hates his sister and, you know, he makes toilet jokes and things. And there is just an essential truth to that, that is the reason it stood the test of time. But is it an excellent, excellent film? Nah, it's all right.
Yeah.
You know, watch it if you've got nothing else to do, but don't go out of your way. That's my advice.
So you wouldn't buy it then?
Well, I had to buy it so that we could do this this podcast, even.
Yeah.
But I only bought it because it was a fiver. I wouldn't have bought it if it was a tenner.
I don't even know if I'd pay a fiver for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's a fiver? I spent more than that on gum.
Never mind. So, yeah. So, not exactly the strongest start, but it certainly does have a following.
There are moments... It's a good starting point for him to then develop that kind of teenage angsty thing that he goes on to perfect in other films.
Yeah, and oh my god, does he step that up in the next one? What's the next one called, Suze?
I don't know, what is the next one called?
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know what
we're doing. Well, you're not coming back for the next one, but you are coming back for the end of this podcast, when we're going to discuss Some Kind of Wonderful.
Yes, yeah. Which is Pretty in Pink Remake.
But in the meantime, I'm off to join a different club. Okay, so it's time for The Breakfast Club now, and joining me for that is Shane Meekings. Hey, Shane.
Hello.
Hey, right, 1984. 2004, I think, The Breakfast Club came out, and this was the, I think it was the second one that I saw. I saw this after Ferris Bueller's Day Off, and...
What age did we see this? Because I was like 9 when that came
really?
Out.
Yeah, oh yeah, I didn't see when it came out. I saw it when we were at high school, so I was like 15, 16 when I saw it, because it came on telly. No, I absolutely loved it, because, I mean, I'd then picked up on John Hughes's work, because, you know, I mean, growing up, I think the first film that I noticed coming out was Pretty in Pink, because the Psychedelic Furs had a song in the charts, Pretty in Pink. And it was showing you clips, and although I sort of thought, oh, that looks okay, at the same time, I wasn't a teenager, so I was like, that's not for me, that would be more something my brother would be into, because he was at the right age, my oldest brother, so I took no interest. It was only as I became a teenager myself that I started to pick up on these films, and that came through Ferris Bueller. And then when this one came on telly and I watched it, just fell in love instantly.
Yeah, it's one of them films.
I can quote it from start to finish. What's amazing about this is that each of the 5 characters are extreme cliches.
Absolutely, every school had them.
But I think the film wouldn't work if they weren't.
No, it's what it needed. I think that was the whole point.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You literally had the extremities between... Yeah. Each, I mean, sort of type of person.
Yeah, yeah. Because, I mean, every John Hughes film, I mean, if you listen to the intro of this podcast, there's just a lot of emo crap out there. Kids, you know, not understanding where they are, not getting on with parents, not getting on with school teachers, not getting on with, not getting on with each other. And this one is full of that to the brim. But I think because each of the characters is a stereotype, make its points a lot better.
Yeah, it really worked. I mean, these are... You have, like, a representative of a group of kids which... Apart from the fact if they weren't in that detention, they would never in their school life interact with each other.
Certainly at that age.
The bully.
And because I mean, I certainly saw a lot of that when I was when we were at school.
Yeah, absolutely.
It wasn't to that. It wasn't to a heavy extreme, but you did see that. But as you sort of got older at high school, when you're in your sort of last years, you started to adapt to each other a bit easier.
Yeah.
And if you got stuck in a room or in a classroom or on a table with people that you didn't necessarily talk to her or whatever, you did get on just fine, as these 5 do. As
did
the,
you
as
go
this
to
day
the same
goes on.
School as me?
Yeah, but it is a great setup. I mean, do we have Saturday detentions in this country?
No, I never attended any Saturday detention.
We have after school detention here?
I mean, let's face it, teachers can't wait to get out of the door at 3:30. They're not going to come in on
a
Saturday.
I don't think they...
They have 6 weeks off and then another day off for teacher training day. So, yeah, it's not going to happen. We don't have that over here.
Yeah, so it's a Saturday detention and it's, you know, the 5 of them are there. There's a janitor running around who's very funny.
Yeah.
And then the teacher, played by Paul Gleason, who really...
Nailed it.
I mean, with him, it's mainly his scenes, the dialogue that he has with John Bender. Judd Nelson's character, and you know, Nelson pretty much steals the film.
He was my favourite character, I think, out of the 5.
Yeah, I think instantly for a lot of people he's the favourite character, because he's the one that's swearing, just being abrupt, you know, literally from the get go. He doesn't give a shit,
doesn't hold anything back,
and he does get put in his place at one point by the teacher when they're alone, when he locks him in the fucking closet,
which can't be legal. That
was quite sort of harsh, but at the same time you're
teacher
like
teacher threatening to beat the shit out of his
pupil. Yeah. Well, I mean, it sort of shows the kid that it's like, well, here's what happens when the shoe's on the other foot, when I'm talking the way you do and then I don't give a shit about anything.
It's quite intimidating and it literally shuts him up. Yeah, that was quite a powerful scene.
Yeah,
especially watching it at the age we were at.
No, absolutely.
I'd like to have seen the reaction had we have been spoken to by a teacher like that. I think it would have been pretty similar.
Yeah. But I mean, obviously, the teacher in this did it the right way where no one else was listening.
Yeah. I think they call that child abuse.
Yeah. Yeah, a few pointers out there for anyone who's looking to abuse children verbally or otherwise.
Make sure nobody else is in earshot.
And it will be their word against yours.
Very hard to prove.
But, I mean, again, even though they're stuck in this library all day long, John Hughes finds ways of making the film interesting throughout, just by the different types of conversation they have, and, you know, literally right off the get-go, it's about, you know, what each of them represent to each other.
Yeah.
And you've got, you know, Brian in the background babbling on about, you know, all the sort of stuff, that, you know, all the clubs that he's joined to and stuff like that.
Physics club.
Yeah, that's right.
Latin club, math club.
And literally they're all just sort of, you know, attacking each other, except Ali Sheedy, who's just in the background saying fuck off. And she's great.
She's class. Make the picture with the dandruff. draws a nice black pencil picture and then Crad Snow for Dan. Yeah, she was mental.
Yeah, but then it's like, then he'll write a scene about them having lunch, and you know they've each brought a different type of lunch with them, and you get to sort of observe that.
And even that sort of separates them from each other.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. Yeah. And then, and obviously, John Bennett is literally in each scene just turning everything on its head and making fun out of everybody's
ripping the shit out of people.
Yeah, but I mean, it does get out of the room every now and again because they do go on a bit of an excursion.
Is that when they go
around
to get the drugs from the
locker, so they can all get high, and they end up having to sort of run around. And when they can't find their way back,
but that show, I think, what I really liked about that scene, that really showed the sort of quite a strength in John Bender's character by sort of taking one for the team, and he was like always in trouble, so he really couldn't give a shit if he's in trouble again. And
instead of
everybody getting caught, he sort of, it's like the soldier thing, isn't it? You know,
and that's where you start to like him even all the more. He's not just a bully.
He's like I say, although the characters were very stereotypical and like I say, they were very sort of very apparent who they were supposed to be representing.
Yeah.
It wasn't as black as white as it seemed as the film went on.
No, absolutely.
When their characters start to develop and they find out, you know, they have got certain things in common, or they're not quite as probably pleased to be representing the actual groups that they're representing.
Yeah. What did you think about the scene when they're all getting high? Because this is where Andrew Michael Hall...
I didn't like the bit where the glass smashed. I was just like...
Oh, where they're dancing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Although it's very funny. But no, I liked it. It was nice. It was... Is that the way had all the lipstick out as well? And she's doing, you know, what's your magic
That's right, trick, yeah. Yeah, John Bender's like just going through all her stuff as well.
That
and
was definitely
Andrew
like
Michael
the team
Hall is
building
completely
bit,
off, Brian's
it?
Completely off his head and he's doing, you know, voices and what have you.
That was like the team building bit where they all start... connecting together a bit. Yeah. No, that wasn't... Yeah, that worked
Because
well.
At this point, John should be locked in the closet.
Yeah.
But he's
snuck his way back
in. Snuck his way back through the roof. But, I mean, then towards the end of that... Because the teacher sort of falls out of the picture by this point.
Yeah.
And it's literally all about them reaching this sort of crescendo. And you get that huge sort of fallout that they have when they're all just sitting down on the floor. And John, you know, really lays into Claire because she's well off.
Yeah.
Basically, and it's going back and
his
forth.
His childhood, and
but I like the fact that throughout the film you find out slowly why each one of them is there.
Because
the first one you hear, I think, is John Bender who set off the fire alarm.
Yeah,
and then you find out Claire went shopping.
Yeah.
Oh no, you find hers out immediately at the beginning when she's coming out the car because the dad says it to her. And then you find out John's, and then you find out the jock who
tanned somebody's arse.
A bit into it, and then you get the sort of really dramatic one. You get is Brian's, who had a flare gun in his locker because he was contemplating suicide, and it went off in a locker, and that's what
because he made a lamp, and the lamp didn't work, and
because
he had to be like top of the class at everything, and that was his big failure, and couldn't go on.
But I like that. I think they saved the best for last. It's like once all the drama's out of the way. Ali Sheedy just said she just had nothing better to do.
She thought she'd come to detention.
She didn't actually even have detention there. She just showed up.
But that fit her character brilliantly because she was just a goofball.
Yeah. Now, the outcome of this, let me ask you, do you think the next day on school these five would actually talk to each other or would ignore each other?
I think you would have gone back.
Yeah?
Exactly.
Even though two of them have become couples.
I think on the Saturday... Would it have lasted?
I don't believe Estevez and Ali Sheedy becoming an item.
No.
Because she gets completely transformed, and it's like, yeah, okay, fair enough, but I was like, those two as a couple? Yeah, he would look at her and go, damn, she's good looking, but what are they going to talk about?
Exactly. I don't think any of them would have worked.
I can see Bender talking to Brian... Because I reckon he'd go up to Brian, and Brian's, you know, he's harmless, Brian's not argumentative, Brian's a nice, just a nice kid. I reckon he'd say hi to him in the corridor. I don't think he'd hang around having a long conversation.
Yeah, he actually was a sort of character that I don't think would follow his... Well, did he even have many friends? I suppose he would have had a certain group
A bunch of geeks, I guess. But yeah, I could see those two sort of, you know, sort of... So I could see Brian sort of looking at the others, you know, waiting for them to say hello. And I reckon John would definitely say hello to him. And possibly Ally Sheedy's character would probably say hello to people.
Yeah, she was pretty harmless.
Yeah, because a lot of it is to do literally with the pecking order at the school.
Yeah.
So you think Claire would be sort of... Claire and Emilio Estevez's character.
The top of the
name?
Chain. I can't even remember what his name was, wasn't it?
Andrew!
Andrew, yes.
Andrew Clark, front and center. Yeah, those two would be the sort of like the two that would drop the ball, there you go, to coin a phrase, if they didn't start talking to each other, I guess. Yeah. But, you know, the film sort of makes its point at the end, and it ended
on a nice note. Let's not worry about what happened
song.
On the Monday. Yeah, and that's
great song.
I love that song.
Yeah, no, that was a great little moment at the end that you have there. But, yeah, no, I can literally just watch this and just fly through the dialogue as it happens. It is still good.
It's very good.
And again, it's not one that's dated all that badly.
No, not at all.
Because
like,
it is literally stuck in the wrong place.
And, yeah.
Yep.
Dialogue is just normal dialogue.
Yeah.
Fashion. Not really that out
there. One for your kids as they're growing up.
Absolutely.
Excellent. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
But now it's time to move on to Weird Science.
From my heart and from my hand, why don't people understand my intention?
Okay, well, we move on now to Weird Science, and with me to talk about that is Ben Pegley. Hello, Ben.
Hello, how you doing?
I say with me, you're on a phone line 80 miles away, but still. 1985. The fact about this film that I never forget is, and I don't even know how true it is, but apparently John Hughes wrote the script in 2 days.
Really?
That's the internet rumour. In fact, not even just the internet rumour, I read that, you know, a long time ago. Apparently, it was a well-known fact. It was like one of the quickest scripts ever written, and apparently he did it in 2 days. I don't know if that was just the first draft, or if that was the finished product.
Well, there we are. I mean, I wonder what gave him the inspiration for it then. You know, hey, I know, 2 kids.
Yeah. So, when did you see this one? Did you go see this at the cinema?
No, it was... it was definitely a video thing, this one, though, when it came out the following year.
I was very excited because it had Hudson from Aliens in it, even though that you made this before Aliens.
Yeah, well, this is the thing. I mean, at the time, in fact, when I saw it, I can't actually remember whether I saw it before I saw Aliens or not, really. But so Paxton was... you know, he's obviously man of the match in this film for me. I mean, we're getting a bit ahead of ourselves, but, you know, his character is just, you know, worth watching the whole film for, really, for his little bits. You know. Even if you don't like the rest of it, which I love, the whole of it, but there you go.
No, I mean, on the introduction music track that I put at the beginning of this podcast, it's littered with Bill Paxton quotes. You hear very, very little from the actual two main guys, but if there's a Weird Science moment in the sort of 3-minute bit that I put together, it's always Bill Paxton, because most of his lines are so quotable.
They are. But although, to be absolutely fair, Anthony Michael Hall was obviously the... You can tell when you watch it that he is the one who is kind of being set up as being, future star or, you know, star. You know, he's the star already, in fact, you know, from Breakfast Club and everything. And he does have some cracking dialogue, actually. He does have some good stuff. But if you have to really choose it, then, you know, Paxton stuff is just dynamite. You know, my favourite being how about a nice greasy pork sandwich served in a dirty ashtray?
Now, apparently that was actually Paxton's line. He actually came up with that.
Oh, really? That was an ad lib, was it? Excellent.
Yeah.
Oh, well,
yeah.
There we are. And it's
I saw this one on video as well. Or it might have even been TV, and then I bought it on video. Because I probably was just not quite old enough to see it. Because it's a 15, this one.
It was, it was a 15.
Yeah, so I probably would have been about 11. I mean, I didn't see it when it came out, but I saw... Yeah, it was. It was definitely television, now that my mind's catching up with me. Yeah, I absolutely loved it. But this one is obviously so different from the rest, because it's much more of a science fiction sort of setup.
Yeah.
These two boys that create this woman.
Their computer and their... Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's an effects, tour de force, really. I mean, the time when you think of it, 85, and the amount of special effects in there that were at the time really quite cutting edge, you know. Photographs on the wall suddenly moving and, coming to life and that sort of thing, and all the kind of graphic stuff with the cars disappearing and all that kind of, stuff was really, it was quite impressive at the time, you know.
Not to mention a lot of quite big practical effects as well, because, you end up with a giant rocket sticking through the centre of this house at the end.
That's right, yeah.
And whatever the hell you want to call that thing Bill Paxton turns into.
Hi, dudes!
This big brown blobby toad like thing.
Yeah. that is just the superb.
No, that was a perfect bit of editing when it just cuts back to him and he's just this giant blob.
Quit screwing around! This isn't funny, you stupid bitch!
Yeah, I mean, you've got other actors in the background, like, Robert Downey Jr. in one of his sort of small roles before he became a big thing.
Yeah, and he's really good as well.
Is good. And the other guy, Robert Russler, who Shane and I talked about in our podcast for Vamp.
All right, yeah.
Kelly LeBrock, what did she go on to do, apart from The Woman in Red and then that bloody awful Seagal film?
Well, this is a thing with her, isn't it? I mean, she was, again, one of those actresses that at the time was, like one to watch, and, she was, like, going to do great things. And, it seems to have just tailed right off. Woman in Red was massive, and Weird Science was, having her in Weird Science was awesome, because it was like everyone knew, that this was the Woman in Red, and... I always thought it was a really kind of interesting thing that considering the role she plays in Weird Science, and considering the fact that she got a kit off in Woman in Red, and that the Weird Science is a 15, I always thought it was interesting that she actually didn't get a kit off really in Weird Science. It was like, well, that's kind of, I don't, that's a kind of weird thing. I was like, hey, missed a trip.
Well, she had a shower with the boys, but you don't see it.
Yeah, she keeps her back to them all the time, though.
Yeah,
you don't see anything. It's rather tasteful, It's but she's gorgeous in it. I mean, she was.
And
just
in fact, she actually only really sort of snogs one of them. That's about as far as she goes.
Yeah,
And it's a really dull drip out of the two of them and all.
Yeah. Wyatt.
I suppose he needed the confidence.
Wyatt, don't No, it's brilliant, and she was great in it as well. I mean, this is the thing, I thought she was smashing, and I mean, really, really loads of potential, I thought, and maybe the Seagal film was the kiss of death for her. I don't know.
Yeah, because she married him around that time as well, didn't she?
Did she? Oh, maybe
Steven
that was
Seagal,
it.
Yeah, they are together no more, but yeah, still. Mm. But yeah, no, bit of a shame. But then you could say the same about the two main leads. I mean, the dull drip, Ian Mitchell-Smith or something. I haven't seen him in anything else. And then Anthony Michael Hall, his career sort of took a bit of a downward turn, and he just sort of popped up every sort of now and again. Edward Scissorhands, I think, was the next film of note that I saw him in. And then after that, The Dark Knight.
Well, yeah. Well, this is the thing, isn't it? I think what happened with Anthony Michael Hall was that he kind of... I think he wasn't... He was one of those... sort of teenage actors, stars, whatever you want to call it, that who obviously just didn't make the transition into being an adult very easily, because when he turned up in Edward Scissorhands, I remember thinking, shit, that's Anthony Michael Hall, but he'd kind of, he was playing the kind of butch jock type, you think that, and
that's
like, oh, that's kind of weird, it didn't sit right at all, and it sort of was a very odd transition, I think. I mean, the feeling I got was that it was a difficult thing for him to transfer from being that kind of skinny, goofy kid from Breakfast Club and Weird Science into something else,
But, I mean, you see him now, and I don't recognise him as the kid from the John Hughes films. Like, when I saw him in The Dark Knight playing the main sort of television reporter on there, it took me a while to realise that it was him.
Yeah,
because I knew he was in it, because I saw his name on a cast roll or something, and I was like, oh my god, that's him, wow, he looks so different now. He actually does look like sort of jock type.
Mm. Yeah, he's filled out and it's just he's not.
Yeah.
I mean, I saw him in the TV series that the Dead Zone adaptation, the Stephen King.
All right.
He was the lead in that. He played the Christopher Walken part in the TV.
All right.
Yeah, and this is a few years ago, but I remember thinking that that's Anthony Michael Hall, and you just think, yeah, that's the guy from Weird Science or from Breakfast Club, you know.
I love the fact that this film just literally just leaps all over the place, because you don't know, once the girl is there, it's like, where's the plot going to go from here? And it's like, first it's a night out in the town, and then, you know, obviously it ends with this giant party at the house, which just goes absolutely nuts. It's all over the shop. It's so, I don't even know what word to call it. I can't say farcical, because it's not farcical. It's just crazy, especially when they try and create another woman, and then literally every room in the house just gets turned upside down, and wind starts blowing all over the place, and rockets come up through the center of the bedroom, and there's just everything is just going absolutely batshit crazy, and
then into this, connect the doll.
You know, these two guys decide, oh, the best thing for us to do is hide in the closet, and then she gets the biker gang in. And you get that great cameo from Vernon Wells, sort of reprising, sort of, that role from Mad Max 2.
Yeah, and Michael Berryman.
Michael Berryman, yeah. who doesn't want to lose his teaching job.
Can we keep this between us? I'd hate to lose my teaching job.
That's right, yeah. And I don't know who the third guy was, but he was like, you know, call me, we'll do lunch. You know. Yeah, it's great. I mean, you know, you can't. In fact, who was the chick? Who was the girl who was part of that
game? Well, you have a lovely home.
you have a lovely home. She's great.
But that's it was great. Literally every line that Vernon Wells says, it just cracks me up as well, when he's just, you know, insulting these two. And basically embarrassing them, the pair of them, in front of everybody, because he knows every little intimate detail about what they get up to.
That's right, yeah.
You know, masturbating and, you know, showering with their jeans on.
And with a great big magnum hand cannon that he suddenly pulls out from... and Gary's parents, I just had to remember his parents, you know, because she obviously, Lisa pulls that spell on them, doesn't she? So he doesn't, his dad doesn't know who... didn't remember him, and so the wife is going, you know, Gary, our son. Yeah, I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah,
it was great. I've got to watch it again.
Oh, yeah, no, you got me thinking about that now.
Yeah.
Do you think Gary was acting kind of strange this evening? Gary? Who's Gary?
Yeah, who's Gary? That's right.
But it's great because, you know, the party wraps up once everybody's buggered off is when, you know, the next morning's when Bill Paxton comes back and the place is still trash.
Yeah.
And I like the fact that when he wakes up Gary, he wakes up Gary and Gary's newfound girlfriend, and he starts whacking him on the head with the shotgun.
With the shotgun, yeah.
It really sounds like it hurts
a lot. Really does. Although the thing's bending all over the place, isn't it? Did you notice? I always noticed that even at the time, that the barrel of the double barrel of the shotgun is very, very bendy.
Really?
Yeah. When he clocks her on the head with it, it sort of goes dong. The sound effect makes it work, though.
Yeah. No, the sound effect really sold it to me.
Chet but arrives back, yeah.
Yeah. And you get that, again, the great scene that when he's got them all lined up, literally military style in the kitchen, and he's just, you know, berating a lot of them and finds the grandparents and, you know, in the cupboard.
Hi, Gramps. With that, hi, Gramps.
Yeah, with that look of glee on their faces.
Yeah. Do you know how disrespectful that is?
It's that great wedgie that he gives him right after that line as well.
Yeah.
A real crunching sound.
Yeah.
So, what did you think about the Chet monster?
I love it. I mean, I wouldn't even begin to try and quote the stuff, but, you know, just, he's awesome. I mean, like I said, man of the match is Paxton, and, yeah, he just totally takes it a whole nother level in terms of funniness. And I love that stuff at the end with when he turns into the, when she turns him into the, sort of whatever that bloody thing is. It's like a big poo.
Yeah.
And he's trying to catch that fly, isn't he?
Oh my god.
That's a there's little eyebrows that are wiggling up and down excitedly when he sees a fly.
That's right, yeah. And you know, the truth is, I love you.
I love you.
Yeah. Oh, God. It's a great movie. It never fails to make me laugh and cheer me up.
It still stands up, I think.
It's one of those movies. In fact, every now and again, you know, I mean, comedies are, you know, but it's like every now and again a film comes along that just tickles your funny bone in a way that, you know, other movies don't quite, you know. And I mean, I think the last one that really did that for me was Anchorman, you know. So Anchorman kind of, for some reason, that character, the setting, the script, you know, everything about it just tickled me pink, you know. It was absolutely, makes me laugh every time I watch it. I can watch it and over and over. Whereas the same year, sorry to get off topic, but the same year, you know, was I think Dodgeball, and I enjoyed that immensely, but I don't ever repeat watch that one.
Yeah,
you know, Anchorman I can watch and watch and watch and watch, and I think Weird Science is the same kind of thing for me. You know, it's I never get bored of it.
Yeah, well, I mean, you need the great quotable dialogue, but you also need the element of surprise in there, and Weird Science is full of that, and Anchorman is full of that. There's, you know, things that you don't necessarily expect to happen in scenes.
Yeah,
and I that happened for me this year when I saw Ted.
Oh right, yeah, I haven't seen Ted yet. I still haven't seen it.
Yeah, check out Ted.
Yeah, I know, I like it.
It's an easy 4 for me, but I may even... No, actually, I won't extend it to a 5. I don't think it's as powerful for me as The Breakfast Club or Ferris Bueller, but it's an easy 4. Easily.
It's, you know, it's a different movie. I mean, for me, it's an easy 5. It's I couldn't take anything away from it. It's one of those movies that has entertained me, you know, for 27 years or whatever it is, you know. It's I don't watch it very often, but every time I do, it does the business. So, you know, I can't give it anything other than a 5.
Cool. Well, yeah. Clearly you were the right man to ask to talk about this one then.
Yeah, well, probably yes, I think so.
Yes, I think so. That's a little segment on Weird Science, but now for something completely different, and on to Pretty in Pink. Right, well, on to Pretty in Pink then, and for this one, I've got the website editor, Laura Johnson.
Woo!
Yeah. So you're here for... Welcome back to the podcast, by the way. So Pretty in Pink, this one is 1986. I think you did this one the same year as Ferris Bueller. When did you first see Pretty in Pink? Actually, tell me who's in it first. I want to see how well you know this film.
Oh, man.
Molly Ringwald.
Pretty in Pink is probably the reason that I love Molly Ringwald so much.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's my favourite film that she's in.
Okay.
And it's the reason that I've got such a really bad crush on Andrew McCarthy.
He's really underrated, I think.
I think.
Where is he these days?
I was so in love with him when I was about 12 years old.
Yeah, I wasn't in love with him, but I did like him. I did like him in this film, and it made me appreciate him a lot more in St. Elmo's Fire.
Yeah.
But then he went and did a lot of films pretty much tailored for the ladies, though, like Mannequin and all that sort of business.
I bloody love Mannequin.
Yeah. And he didn't really start doing serious stuff until the 90s hit, but that's when his career sort of, you know, hit a brick wall and went straight to sort of DVD. Did some interesting stuff, though. Did a really interesting straight-to-DVD one called Stag, about a stag party that goes wrong, and he plays the really, really nasty one of the people there.
Shut up, you can't ever imagine him being nasty.
No, but if you saw this, you'd be like, wow, he's really good at it.
I really might have to look it up.
Yeah, so he's the hunky hero, the rich boy,
the rich
in
boy.
This, and James Spader's the sort of nasty piece of work best friend of his.
Yeah.
And then you've got
John Cryer.
John Cryer as the reason why I think this film has taken a nosedive and has dated really badly, because he's the most annoying guy on the planet.
Oh, don't say that.
Mate, loved his character. Fucking, what's it, Ducky?
Yeah.
Ducky. I really enjoyed him when I was young. Now that I'm a proper adult, I cannot stand him.
Oh, he's still cute.
Oh.
Really annoys me when he throws his big hissy fit in the back room of Tracks, but...
Well, when he keeps setting the alarm off?
No, after that, when she's going on a date with Blaine.
All right.
Blaine? His name is Blaine? Oh, that's a major appliance, that's not a name!
But this film does have a saving grace for me as an adult. Well, actually, Harry Dean Stanton's in this as well, as our dad.
Yeah.
Who's good. The soundtrack's pretty good.
Soundtrack's awesome.
The psychedelic first, who did the title track, Pretty in Pink. And you've got a bit of Nick Kershaw in there as well later on, I seem to remember.
Dweezil Zappa's actually in the film.
Really?
Yeah.
You know, he's in The Running Man.
Sure.
In a tiny little role as a guy called Stevie, who's part of this underground resistant movement. Dweezil Zappa. Him and Mick Fleetwood.
That's so weird.
Yeah, it is. It's really weird. Next time you watch if you ever see The Running Man, the names are at the front of the credits as well. As the names sort of come up, you'll suddenly just see them. But Dweezil Zappa's on the soundtrack for this, or is he in the film?
Bit of both, I think.
Oh, no, you're right! He's the mate of theirs that they go to the club with.
Yeah.
What's his name? Because she basically says, what would you do if your dad did this?
Suddenly became rich.
Rich, and he goes, kiss his ass! That's right. Oh, my God, you're right. Simon, that's the name of the character.
I was going to say Simon or Stuart.
Yeah. Simon. Wow. No, the saving grace for me is her best mate, who is...
The blonde one?
No, the lady that owns the record
Iona.
Shop.
Iona.
Yeah.
I love her.
Who, and she's literally just has a different hairstyle every time you see her. I think she's smoking hot. Do you know what she's more famous for?
What?
She's the receptionist at the Ghostbusters.
Sure.
Yeah. Annie Potts, yeah.
That's amazing.
We got one!
That's made me love her even a little bit more, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
The thing is, though, I worry that I've got, like, these set of five girl cousins that are, like, look up to me a little bit. I worry that I am turning into her.
Really?
She acts with Andy.
Well, how old would you say she was in that film? 30s? Early 30s? Mid 30s?
Early, surely.
Just with bizarre taste in music, because she's very into like the 50s. But then you see her all punk in another scene, and then you see her all. Yeah. But she.
That's my favourite outfit when she's got that black latex thing on.
Yeah.
And in mad.
Well, the only outfit that she wears that I don't like is the very last one, which is the really nasty.
She's like yuppie.
Yeah, yuppie 80s working girl look with her blow dried hair, and you're just like, oh, that's nasty. And that's her idea of selling out, and it's wrong. So basically you've got her, who's the rich girl, the poor girl, from the wrong side of the tracks, who fancies the rich guy. Yeah. Now, is he new at school, or something? Because I could never quite figure out, because it's like they've only just seen each other. But you don't get the impression that she's definitely not new, but you don't...
But you don't get the impression that he is, either.
Because he's been hanging out with Jane Spader for... Yeah. Forever and a day. I don't know, there was just something weird about the way he's introduced. It felt like it had kind of a new kid approach, but maybe it's just because she's never noticed him before.
Yeah, I think it's just a case of, you know how it is in school, when you become obsessed with someone and then next week it's over and you move on to someone new.
Yeah, but did you think it was done believably, or do you think it's a bit forced?
Really,
get the girl perspective on this.
It is forced.
Yeah.
And it really upsets me to say that, I'll be honest.
I did actually believe Jane Spader's character in the sense that he had tried to crack onto her. And because she'd rejected him, you know, he'd be like, you're a real bitch, and, you know, all that sort of business and what have you.
Oh, yeah.
And the Ducky thing is completely believable. That he just absolutely adores her, but is obviously... too much of a loser for... That's a bit mean calling him a loser, but he is.
See, I was just going to open up then and say that I've been in that position. I had this best mate at school.
Right. What? Hang on. Are you the girl or are you Ducky?
I'm Ducky.
Really?
Yeah.
You're running around making as much noise and calling attention to yourself.
Well, not necessarily.
Yeah, I don't know.
Like, he was my best friend.
Yeah.
Like, we saw each other, spoke to each other 20 times a day.
Yes.
Yeah. We were probably really only friends because I was madly in love with him. And he...
You had nothing in common.
Well, he totally wasn't interested. And so I know how Ducky feels.
Yeah, but that's a difference between having a close friend that you fancy and being a complete prat and having a friend that you fancy.
Well, no, I don't think the being a prat has got anything to do with him fancying it. He just is a prat.
Yes. Yes. And I was kind of glad at the end that they don't get together. But it toys with it very briefly when she arrives at the prom. And he's wearing them fucking bowling shoes or whatever the hell. And I thought, oh, God, no, that's just wrong. But obviously she ends up with Andrew McCarthy's character anyway.
Yeah.
That's the one thing that Some Kind of Wonderful does do, though. It does make the guy go out with the best friend sort of thing. But it's much more believable because it's not someone who's just hyperactive and annoying. Because then it would feel like they've completely settled for second best.
Yeah,
well, the rich people don't like me, I don't like them anymore, or whatever it is. And screw it, at least this person appreciates me for who I am. So I'll settle for them. It would have been horrible. Did you want her to end up with Ducky? Or when it happened, when you first saw it, mind, if you can project back that far.
Hey! 15 and 12 wasn't that long ago.
It wasn't yesterday either, was it? 12? That's how old you were when you saw it?
I think so.
Yeah, I might have been about that, or maybe a little bit more when I first saw it. But I was still horrified when I saw her walking, you know, when she meets him outside and they go in hand, and I was like, no, that's not right.
I don't know, because I was a bit like, oh, bless. He's come through for her, despite hating, like, what she's been doing.
Well,
he's
come through for her,
and it's really lovely.
Yeah.
But then I was like, yay, she's gone with Blake.
Yeah, I suppose it's quite nice that Ducky came to his senses and stopped being a
dick.
Yeah, basically. Well, or just jealous.
Yeah.
He wasn't being a jealous dick. And he proved that even further when Blaine does come up, and he's come there by himself, and then he leaves, and Ducky says, you know, hey, he came here by himself.
Yeah.
You know, go after him. And then, magically out of nowhere, some other girl in a pink dress appears in the distance, and Ducky notices her, and she looks at him back, and there's the nod of approval, and he looks at the camera.
You have to have a happily ever after.
Yeah. Everybody except James Spader, who's going out with a slut.
Oh, yeah.
But you've got sort of the first instances of internet dating as well, because that's how they first sort of talk to each other, is over a computer.
Yeah.
Because Blaine flirts with her
in
the...
so dated.
I know, and it's like the college life. But it was probably like, you know, a mega progress thing back then, making a picture move from one side of a screen to another.
It's exciting. She's very impressed by it. Like, so she brings it up to tell him how amazing she thought it was.
Yeah, I've got a note down here saying that I was really not impressed with the horrid reggae band. And I think that's a scene that Simon, Dweezil Zappa's in. They're listening to this horrid, horrid reggae music, and it just made me want to puke. But there we go. I think that's all I've got to say about that.
It's the really cheesy, like, synth band that's on at the prom that's the best one.
Oh, right at the very end.
Yeah.
Yeah, with that song that just goes on and on and on, and you get the big euphoric sort of ending. The kiss in the car park. What did you think about the fight that Ducky has with James Spader? Because that's when Ducky first starts to get his redemption. Because he just legs it at him, doesn't he? Yeah. He just starts beating the crap out
like
of him.
Rugby tackles him.
Yeah, that's right. Doesn't do very well, but still.
Much of a fight. They just have a bit of a wrestle on.
A bit of a scuffle, but I like the fact that James Spader, once Ducky's like run off and had a bit of a tantrum against the prom poster, James Spader's standing next to the teacher, and he just spits on the floor.
Yeah.
Inside the school. I was like, that's gross.
It's the fact that the teachers separate them.
Yeah.
They don't say anything to either of them. Not like,
Your bloody unpaid extras in film.
If I had a fight in school, I'd be sent to the head teacher or something, surely.
Yeah.
and but nothing at all. They just separate them and they mince off.
She gets
sent to the head teacher for having a go at the girl in gym class, saying that she hopes that
her tits fall off. Yeah.
Drop off. Yeah.
Yeah, they're very lenient on the boys, though.
Yeah.
Got one last question before we shuffle on to the next subject, so I can give you back your freedom. The prom dress that she wears.
Oh my God.
They're pretty in pink. What is your verdict of that dress?
The two dresses that she mutilates.
Yes.
To make that one.
Thank you, I'm glad you used that word.
Also, like, especially the one that she gets from Iona is so pretty.
Yeah.
And the one that her dad buys it isn't even that bad, to be honest. It's
what the hell
80s,
does she
but
make?
Then she makes this pink sack that I could probably fit in as well as her. That's how well fitting it is.
Yeah.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah, I thought that was a bit nasty. But hey, you know, good luck with that one, Blaine. Well, Ducky gets to go off with his big boob blonde. No, I think this one's dated a bit for me now. You clearly like it. Do you like it as much or more than when you first sort of saw it? I take it still has a special place in your heart.
I was going to say probably more, just for sort of sentimental reasons.
Yeah, cool.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, fair enough. But I think it's obvious that film was made more for you than it was for me.
Oh, it's definitely a girl's film. So,
yeah, definitely. And like I said, you know, the highlight for me is just how hot I think Annie Potts is in it. How good she looks 25 years later, who knows?
I'm going to Google that later.
Yeah. That was certainly the biggest film of both of them, Ghostbusters 1 and 2. She's the receptionist, Janine. So, yeah, that's that one. But thank you.
No problem.
I'm going to move on to the next one. But first, here's some music. So now we turn our attention to Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Now, John Hughes wrote and directed this one as well, and it came out in 1986, I do believe. And with me to talk about this one is Shane Meekings again. Hello.
Hello.
Right, so when did you first see this one?
School holidays, you and me, I think every day for 6 weeks.
Pretty much, yeah. No, my dad brought home a copy of this, and we had it just forever and a day. And yeah, this one became a firm favourite of ours, didn't it?
Yeah, it definitely.
This was the first John Hughes film that I actually saw.
Yeah, I think it was for me also.
I'd heard of
well.
Other ones, but I just wasn't of an age where I was ready for them, whereas no. We were actually at high school at this point, weren't we?
Yeah, but.
So it came along at a right time. Yeah, it made quite the impact.
Well, so, I mean, we were at school at the time, and yeah, it was definitely a film that fit our generation, I guess, at that time.
Yeah, yeah.
Although none of us could drive.
No. Well, we were sort of hitting 13 in 89, and this one came out in 86. So it was a few years before that, but no, it was still relevant. It wasn't. Oh, absolutely. It wasn't an out of date.
No,
teen
not,
comedy.
Not by any. No, not at all.
And you know, it had little. You know, there was the typical rebellion. And I mean, I look at Ferris Bueller now, and I'm like, he's actually a bit of a dick.
That's a bit harsh.
Who does get away with literally everything? But yeah, then again, at the same time, spoiled. He's got a principal who's acting like a complete and utter stalker.
He was interesting.
Yeah, well, he gets his in Rooney. This film. But, I mean, I'd not seen a film like this. I've not seen a film like this since, you know, just basically a couple of kids skiving off school.
And no, the it's day just they like have. Their adventures throughout the day, isn't it?
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
I've not seen anything.
Yeah, and then and they're not just, like, running around, you know, smoking out the fucking
they're
back
actually
of the school.
Doing
they're actually
something
doing
with
stuff,
the day,
and they're
yeah.
actually getting cultured, as it were. They're visiting art galleries.
Sitting in somebody's house getting pissed like we
oh,
did.
Oh, God,
when we
the snooty restauranteur guy.
Oh, that's... Yeah,
hello,
that
may I help you? What is it? Who he pretends to be? Abe Froman,
Abe
the Sausage
Froman,
King of Chicago.
Yeah.
It's got some class dialogue, but I think the film is all but stolen by his best mate, Cameron Fry.
Oh, he was just brilliant. Everybody wanted a friend like him. He's
just so morose about everything and just doesn't want to do anything for Ferris, and ultimately ends up paying the price for tagging along with Ferris.
Get all the conscience in the voice in your head which tells you you really shouldn't be doing these things. Yeah,
but it's the great scene that they have when he has convinced Cameron to, you know, I mean, Cameron's got the day off anyway because he's ill, or he's ill in his head anyway.
He's always ill, I get the impression.
And he goes over begrudgingly to Ferris's house, and then they've got to try and get a way of getting Ferris's girlfriend out of the school, and it's when they make the fake phone call to
about the granddad's passing
away. And, and it's really
genius.
Well, it's really well edited, because Ed Rooney is on to him because he's like, this is bullshit. But Ferris cleverly has gotten Cameron to make the phone call and phones in on another landline to say, hey, it's me, can you get my sister to send home from some paperwork so I can do some homework?
Yeah.
And it's just a look
don't
on
they
Ed
set
Rooney.
Up like a series of answer phone messages and things as well?
Yeah, they all do that. Because even at Cameron's house, they use that as the number for Sloane, and it's like, you know, we're off at a funeral. We'll...
Oh, I can't remember how it goes now, but you hear like the funeral music
or funeral
something
music
going on
in the
background. We can't be.
But it's great that
up
until that point, you think that it's Ferris making the phone call as well. And Ed Rooney's like, you know, it's Ferris Bueller, I'm going to set a trap for him and let him fall right into it. And then he just ends up just putting his feet up on his desk, kicking back, and just swearing at the guy on the other end of the phone. And that's when Ferris Bueller actually phones in. You just see the alarm bells going off on this guy's face, and it's like, oh, shit!
Scrapping around the office trying to put it right.
That has got my favourite line. Ferris is in the background telling Cameron, you don't tell them to do that because it'll look too suspicious. Cameron's acting on sort of a panic. Does that thing when he clears his throat. And he goes, I've changed my mind. I want you out in front of the school with her. I'd like to have a few words with you, by God.
You think, how is he going to get around this one?
It's a class moment. But I think it's weird that when they go to pick up Sloane outside the school, he's dressed like Inspector Gadget.
And
talks like Inspector Gadget, and then in the years to come, he would go on to play Inspector Gadget.
I think that's probably, he was touted from that.
Yeah, point. But the weird thing is that when he did play Inspector Gadget, he didn't do the voice of anything.
Should have just fought back to his Ferris Bueller days.
Yeah, exactly.
It would have gone down a
Sloane,
lot better.
Sloane, dear, hurry along now. Now, you've spotted something about the license plates.
Yeah, the license plates on some of the cars, they were abbreviations of other John Hughes films. I can't remember some of them off the... I think one of them was Mr. Mum. Yeah. 4FBDO, which is for Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Yeah.
I think there's one for the Breakfast Club.
Yeah.
That's a useless bit of information for
Hey,
you.
I'll be looking for it the next time I watch it. Yeah, so I mean, they go off into town in the Ferrari.
Yes.
Right, tell me, what's the name and make and model of the Ferrari?
I have no idea.
Isn't it the 1960...
Oh, hang on. There was a speech.
Exactly.
Cameron had a speech. Oh, no, it escaped me. It was red. It was a nice, shiny red.
It wasn't.
I'm just speaking like
I just don't
my
remember the year,
would.
But I want to say 1962 GT California.
Something like that.
I know Chris and Ben are slapping their foreheads going, fuck's sake, get it right. But it's a beautiful car.
Very nice.
And
it meets its
demise. But you've got that great sequence where they rip off the Star Wars music when they put it into the garage.
Yeah, the
and
guys.
And the two guys that just go for a joyride in it.
Oh, that's brilliant.
And you just see the car flying over the head, entering the camera, much like the bloody Star Destroyer at the beginning of Star Wars with the music playing.
Yeah, it really picks up after that point, doesn't it, once they're in like the in the big city, getting up to their antics, what was the baseball games.
That's right.
I always quite like that scene.
It's you just get all these little random things happening that you just...
Like, say, the art gallery they went to visit.
Yeah, but I mean, the baseball game's great because he actually catches a ball, doesn't he? And he's like jumping up and down. And he ends up on TV, and Ed Rooney's like wandering around town trying to find him, and he's on TV in the background. Stuff like that. That's really great. And all the Save Ferris stuff as well.
And one of my favourite bits is the when he's on the float doing the twist and shout.
Yeah, I
love that
scene. The Beatles
scene,
yeah.
Very feel good for the film. I always like that scene, and I've always liked that song ever since, actually.
Me too. I'm not a huge Beatles fan, but that's one of the sort of few that I do
actually
really like.
It's always stuck in my head, that song. Whenever I hear it, it's Ferris Bueller.
But I can always spot all the random people in the crowd that they filmed as well throughout the song,
like
the triplets.
Yeah.
Business triplets.
People start dancing. Yeah,
and even his dad's up in his office having a dance as well. What did you make of Sloane, Mia Sara?
Fit. I always quite, nice. Never had girls like that at our school. That always bummed me out. Never had girls like her at our school.
No. But then did we have guys like that at our school?
No. I don't think there's anybody that interesting at all.
I always wonder why the hell is it that they end up at this stock exchange at one point when they're having that Cameron's giving them that speech about, you know, his parents, you know, I know two people, you know, my parents, they're married and they hate each other. It's when Ferris says to Sloane, "Will you marry me?" sort of thing.
Yeah.
And she just laughs at him. And they're at the stock exchange.
Well, why not? Why not see it when you're in Chicago? It's a day out.
I guess. I just kind of thought that John Hughes thought, right, where haven't we been in Chicago? Well, there's the stock exchange. That's what I've seen in there.
Ticked all the places off.
Yeah. I suppose we should talk about Ed Rooney a little bit as well.
Yeah, I think
Geoffrey Jones, who nailed this part. I don't know, because I mean, you've got the school teacher in The Breakfast Club who made a hell of an impact, and that was a tough one to top, but I think they did it with
absolutely Jeff. I mean, he's just like
any secretary
bumbling
actually.
And I don't know, he's like a stalker type. I don't know, he's like a head teacher predator type, you know. Fair enough, kids bunk off, but I'm going to get out of my office, I'm going to track this guy down and I'm going to make his life a misery,
and I'm going to break into his house if I have to to do it.
And he just didn't give a hoot.
And then
more schools need head teachers like that nowadays. We wouldn't have half the crime we have now if we had like teachers literally out in the streets tracking these kids down.
But it's great. I mean, while you've got all this stuff going on in town with Ferris and his girlfriend and Cameron, you've got loads of stuff going on back at the house, especially when Ed shows up, because he does have to break in, and you've got the dog running around, and you've got the sister who comes back home, and then you've got people ringing on the doorbell constantly. There's all this Save Ferris stuff going on, and then
on round the school as well, having collections and trying to buy him a kidney, was it?
That's right.
Transplant.
But it's just great. You've got these two people trying to prove that he's taking the day off, and you know, and the sister proves it because she legs at home busting in the bedroom and sees the dummy.
But even she ends up in a whole kind of trouble. She ended up in the police station, did she not, because of the
well exactly, because she tries to because Ed Rooney's in the house and she knocks him out and she has to phone the police, and then the police don't believe her and they pick her up instead, and that's where
and
she ends up meeting
Charlie Sheen
in his little cameo.
I think
and it's literally him that makes her chill out.
I think they said to make him look like that, he didn't sleep for 2 days. That's why he looked so rough and druggified in the film. He actually didn't sleep for 48 hours in preparation for the scene.
Oh, well, it worked.
He looked good. Don't know what his excuse is nowadays.
No.
Well, you've got obviously the final scenes after the after their fun day out when
he has to
go home and it hits reality that there's...
You've got to mention about the fucking car, though.
Hell of a lot of mileage on the car.
Yeah, hell of a lot of mileage on the car. So they stick it in reverse.
Stick it in reverse and up on blocks. And, I kind of knew even at that age that wasn't going to work.
But, it did gobsmack me the moment that the car goes flying out the window, because Cameron has his attack and he starts kicking the car and shouting about his dad because he hates his dad. and you just think, oh my god, because he actually kicks the grill in.
How's he going to explain the dent? Yeah,
yeah, he actually dents the front of it and kicks the grill in the front, and you know, he's sort of like having
his
like,
dad
god.
Would have been mad with just
yeah,
that.
Yeah, 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 and you just don't see it coming, and he's just like, I just can't wait to see the look on the bastard's face, and then just leans on the fucking thing, yeah, and it just goes, and it goes flying out the window backwards.
And he was okay about it. For yes. the whole film, it was quite a good turning point with the character, because for the whole film he was just scared, and
yep.
this is like his turning point.
Yeah,
I think,
well, it's like at that point,
he's,
you know,
making a,
what else
he said, I am making a stand. And
yeah, but yeah, I would have liked to have seen that scene.
Yeah, that wouldn't work.
Getting the shit kicked out of him by his dad.
That wouldn't have worked on my dad. That wouldn't. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. I've crashed your car. I'm making a stand. I'm not taking your shit anymore.
Bang.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would have liked to have seen the aftermath of that, but yeah, we never got to see that, unfortunately.
And then you get a nice little, because obviously when they leave him to
yeah, the bit in the swimming pool as well. I thought that was where that. I mean, going back a little bit now,
yeah.
but I really like that scene of him in the swimming pool where he's not pretending to drown, but he just sort of sinks and sits at the bottom
and just sort of looks around.
Yeah. And they pull him out of the swimming pool and you get the Ferris Bueller, you're my hero. Genius. Yeah, I love that bit. It all starts flooding back to you, doesn't it?
It's a highly quotable film. I mean, I yeah. could watch this film and just, you know, repeat the...
Word for word.
I've seen it that often, and it is...
Having said that, neither of us could remember what the car was called, even though there's a speech and everything.
Yeah, oh, God.
But that's
technical. That's the thing, though. If we had it on the telly now, I bet you we would just say it.
Yeah, need prompting.
Yeah.
So, answers on the postcard, anybody?
Yeah, no, I think this is actually my favourite John Hughes film out of a lot.
Possibly because
it was the first one that I saw, but because it is so well written.
I think if this is my favourite, I think Breakfast Club comes a very close second, but I'd have trouble picking between the two, I think.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But there really isn't a lot in it, if anything at all.
And I think... I don't know if it's out of date. I mean, yeah, it was made in the mid-80s, but there's nothing about it that...
It's aged really well.
It has.
It has aged really well.
It looks
like I say,
good.
If you watched it now, it'd still be
Yeah, it's
very
really
relevant.
Well shot. I mean, it's not like you get a lot of films made in the 70s where, you know, haircuts date them, whatever.
Yeah,
you know,
the
haircuts are really sort of normal and what have you. The fashions look okay. They don't look too 80s.
Well, it all comes back round anyway, doesn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. And, you know, there might be, you know, aspects of things here and there that, you know, look a bit old, but apart from that, it is pretty well sort of done.
It's aged very well.
Yeah, I think it's one that lasts, and it has lasted.
I'm looking forward to introducing my kids to it when they're old enough to appreciate
it. Yeah, definitely. That'd be an interesting experiment to see how they react.
And then I'll just keep tags, making sure they go to school the day after.
Because, I mean, you think, like, about 10 years later or so, you had the sort of new batch of films that were coming out for, you know, for teenage audiences, and it was stuff like Clueless with Alicia Silverstone, and I can't watch that because the way that the
it's just dumbing
the kids
people
speak
down
is,
it really is dumbing people down films like that.
And you know, I mean, that film may have its clever aspects here and there, because I mean, isn't it an adaptation of Emma, Jane Austen's Emma, I think, but it's because of the sort of lingo that, you know, it's like with the either the Jane Silent Bob or the Bill and Ted type thing where they invent dialogue, and even Heathers to an extent, where they invent dialogue, the way that teenagers speak, that automatically dates your film.
Yeah.
Because it will not last. Whereas Ferris Bueller doesn't have any of that, they just talk normally.
No fads, just, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Well, this one still gets top marks.
Absolutely.
Yep. Cool.
Top marks.
Well, thank you for that. It's time to move on to the next one. Well, we finally made it to the end, and there's just one more to go, and that's Some Kind of Wonderful. And joining me again, as promised, is Suzanne King.
Hello, Stephen.
Welcome back. Yeah, let's not waste time saying hello. You've already been here
on
this podcast. You just
went
away for half an hour. Now you're back.
So,
Some Kind of Wonderful, 1987.
Yep.
John Hughes wrote this one.
Yep.
He didn't direct it. This was the same guy that directed Pretty in Pink. Well, which is Howard Duch.
Really? Amazed me. Same guy directed Pretty in Pink, because it's the same fucking film, but the other way round.
Yeah, it is.
She would end up with Ducky if it was exactly the same, but...
That's right.
Spoilers.
Yeah. Better written, I think.
No, I prefer
But that might be debatable, because the ladies tend to like Pretty in Pink.
I do like Pretty in
well,
Pink.
Well, the ladies and the guy that runs our social network, because he ran out and bought it on DVD when it came out.
Really?
Yeah, big shout out to Chris Borman out
Hi,
there.
Chris
Hello,
Borman.
Chris. You wanker. So, it is kind of Pretty in Pink. It is, you know, the poor person who fancies the rich person, and they go out kind of on a date sort of thing, and then it has a slightly different outcome.
Yes.
Yeah. So, Eric Stoltz was the main guy in this. Did you like him?
I don't understand why Eric Stoltz is a movie star.
He's not, though, is he? He's more of a... Well, he is, because he is a leading man, isn't he?
Yeah.
Or he was,
well,
certainly in that time. Well, what had he done at this point? I think he'd done Mask. That one was Cher.
Had he been fired by Back to the Future yet?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, that was a couple of years before this as
well.
Well,
that tells you all you need to know, really. That, you know, he's just a bit rubbish. I don't really understand
him. You don't get him?
I don't get him. I don't really... He's got a really weedy voice. Because he's quite a big fella. You know, he's quite tall and...
Yeah.
But he's just got a really...
Is he good looking?
I don't think so. I love a ginger, but he doesn't do it for me. What can
no?
I say? No?
Oh, fair enough. What about Mary Stuart Masterson, who totally did it for me in this film, as the best friend? The drummer.
Yeah, well, yeah. And a chick who plays drums. I mean, you can't...
And she gets that great line that was in the trailer where she says, "This is although it is dated now, this is 1987, a girl can be whatever she wants to be."
Ugh.
So it's, you know, it's forward, exactly, feminism in motion.
She's got an undercut. She's a feminist. Woo! She does have an undercut. I
used to fancy a girl at college who had that haircut. No, university, in fact.
Again, I don't really understand. I don't think she's particularly attractive either. I don't really understand why she's...
Oh, she's dead cute. Because she went on to do Fried Green Tomatoes, which she was very good in.
And she also went on to do Chances Are. Chances Are. Is it called Chances Are?
Is that the one with Robert Downey Jr.?
Yes!
Good Lord.
I loved that film. Yeah. I know I should guilty pleasure.
Where is she these days? Because Eric Stoltz, I'm sure, is doing TV or something.
Yeah, he's probably doing TV.
But I've not heard of her for a long time. It's like the girl from Near Dark, you know, she just disappeared. Jenny Wright.
Gone. Into the ether. Maybe she decided that this fame game wasn't for her.
Yeah, that was just not very good at doing our research. Yeah. We've done a ton of films last year.
Yeah, there's nothing like doing a podcast.
Has her own show. Yeah. All right, what about Leah Thompson then, who played the rich girl, the object of Keith's affection?
Well, now that I understand. I think she's a good actress.
Who was in the Back to the Future films.
She was in Back to the Future, and she would have been Eric Stoltz's mum. Now that would be weird. She'd be Eric Stoltz's mum in Back to the Future. And then, you know, in this film, Eric Stoltz's girlfriend. That would be weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, she's all right. She's good. She's Amanda Jones.
Amanda Jones. Leah Thompson, who is beautiful.
She is beautiful. Is that her character, Amanda Jones?
Mm-hmm.
She's a bit of a bitch, really, isn't she?
Yeah, kind of, you know. But she sorts herself out in the end,
she
makes the right decision, which is to stand on her own.
Oh, it is a feminist
and
film.
Exactly, and not that many women to this day know how to do that. Do you not agree?
Yes.
Danny Dyer appear in this film? No.
No.
Okay. Well, Craig Sheffer then, as the abusive, rich, original boyfriend of hers.
Yeah, see, this isn't as good as Pretty in Pink, because in Pretty in Pink...
If it's in the way he looks these days, Jesus.
Yeah, it doesn't look good. In Pretty in Pink, the arsehole is played by James Spader.
That's right.
Who is amazing.
Yep.
And who makes the film 27% better by virtue of being in it.
Definitely.
This guy
does
not... He doesn't have James Spader's charisma. Yeah. I just think a Pretty in Pink is just...
I remember picking up on Craig Sheffer again when he did Nightbreed, because he was the hero, the heroic lead in Clive Barker's Nightbreed about 3 years after this. And then after that, he did a Hellraiser film, actually, as well. He did Hellraiser 5.
How many Hellraisers have there been?
Which, if I'm honest, I actually did like. There's been 8. No, there's been 9. Because they did a sort of a remake just to keep the rights...
Just
a couple of years
stop
ago.
Fucking solving the puzzle box, people. Stop it. Yeah. Throw it in the bin.
Exactly. What's in the box? Well, that's what they want to know. Back to Some Kind of Wonderful. Yeah. And the dad is played by one of the coppers from Beverly Hills Cop.
When does my life belong to me?
Exactly. Yeah. Where's the fucking money, Keith? John Ashton. Who's forever just trying to send his son to college.
I just...
That thing I didn't understand, the way that argument panned out. I was like, your dad's being... alright, he's a little bit controlling, but he's trying to do a good thing.
Yeah, and you've just wasted all of your college fund on a pair of diamond earrings that aren't even that nice. See that. And also, how fucking expensive were those earrings? Because to save up to send a kid to university in America, it's so expensive.
Yeah.
It's like hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars. How expensive were those diamond earrings?
Well, mind you, this was 87, so it probably wasn't as expensive, but it was probably still quite a few thousand. Yeah, and at the restaurant was the guy that was the maitre d' from Ferris Bueller.
And his friend in that film is...
I was coming to him, okay. The guy that steals the goddamn show for me, Elias Koteas, the bald guy, Duncan.
He's really good.
Who is fantastic. It's a bald guy, Suze. You like bald guys?
Who doesn't like bald
exactly.
guys?
Do you like this guy in this?
Yeah, of course.
He's hilarious.
He looks like he's got a substance abuse problem. Of course I like him.
Yeah. If my friend bald Jonathan was here right now, he'd just be off quoting the lines from Duncan.
See, I would have liked the best friend character, the ducky, if you will, to have ended up with him. That would
Nah, well, he had a girlfriend already, because you saw what she looked like with no skin. I just really like the arc of... Because when they first meet, they fall out.
Yeah.
Keith and this punk Duncan. And then he ends up in detention, deliberately to try and be with Amanda Jones, but obviously she's conned her way out of it. And he gets stuck with all these guys, and you think, uh-oh, what's going to happen here? And then suddenly, the next time you see them, they're getting on. Mm. Which I thought was brilliant.
Yeah.
They were just like, oh, let's just have them both drawing, because they're both artists of an ilk.
Oh, they're always fucking artists.
Duncan uses a knife as opposed to a pen.
It's just like in American films, like teenage-type films, the male lead... is always an artist. I just like want them to be like not even remotely able to pick up a pencil and draw something.
Yeah.
Just be a maths whiz or like books or, you know, they're always a fucking artist. They just draw something. And that carries on to TV shows as well, because I can't tell you the amount of characters in The Vampire Diaries who are like wonderful cartoonists.
I also noticed in these John Hughes films, whenever like the teenagers are blowing off steam, they're always at bars where bands are playing.
Yeah.
Which you get in Pretty in Pink.
Yeah.
When they're out hanging out with bloody Dweezil Zappa, who's one of the friends, who Laura and I picked up on.
Mm.
And in this one, it's the same thing, because that's when Mary Stuart Masson's character, what's she called? Watts.
Yeah, Watts.
She's yeah, you know, has a little breakdown and starts crying because that band, Violet Marches, I think, are on stage playing.
Well,
did you like the soundtrack for this one? I thought it was a vast improvement from the Pretty in Pink one.
I did not think it was a vast improvement from Pretty in Pink.
I love the soundtrack for this. Even because that band that are on stage in that bar, they also did the cover, I believe, of the Rolling Stones song Miss Amanda Jones.
Oh, okay.
And you also hear the Stones version when you get the montage of when he's getting ready.
Yeah.
Which starts really funny because it's basically they all head home to get ready for the date.
Yes.
Right? And he's like in the shower. But at the very beginning of it, you see him running across the road, but he sort of stumbles to a stop because he almost gets run over. I thought it was just a really random shot for them to put in.
Leave it in. We haven't got time to refilm that. So we haven't got time. I just think Pretty in Pink is a better film. I enjoy it.
Really?
Yeah, I like it better. I think the characters are better. I think the acting's better. I think the story's better. Also, what I enjoy twice, about though. Pretty in Pink over Some Kind of Wonderful is that it's the obvious choice that he would end up with the best friend. And in Pretty in Pink, she should really end up with Ducky, but she doesn't.
She should not. Look, we're not here to discuss Pretty in Pink. I've already had that argument with Laura. No, she should not have ended up with fucking Ducky.
You reckon she
the biggest
end up with James
prat
Spader?
On the planet.
I think she should have ended James up with James Spader. Spader too. Who doesn't love James Spader?
No, it is much more predictable here. But it's kind of obvious because they obviously have that kiss midway through the film, where she's teaching him how to kiss a girl properly.
Yeah.
And that it's literally right there. The penny drops for sure, like a ton of bricks on the audience. Yeah, obviously those two are going to get together at the end. But it just kind of happens, because when they go to the house at the end, the party that the bad guy's hosting, they literally have that great showdown with
the bloke.
Craig Sheffer's character, and then you have that even better entrance from Duncan and all his punks, and they're going to, you know, raise things up to a nice, respectable level.
Yeah, what I quite like about that scene is when all the punks enter, all the like, preppy girls at the party suddenly look
start
very,
eyeing
very
them up,
yeah.
Yeah.
Hello, boys. Nice. That's how it
and, you know, because they literally leave that party and they're all jazzed and happy and Watts is outside by the car waiting for them. And it's literally in that moment you sort of, he for some reason looks at her and sees that's what he wants. And then the other girl just goes, well, you two should belong together. I'm going to go hit the road and be by my own.
Yeah, let me give you back these really expensive earrings. I do quite like the bit where he says to her, you look really good wearing my future. That's really good.
And then you get that really horrible Elvis cover.
Yes. Yeah, it's an all right film, but I'd just prefer Pretty in Pink. Given the choice between the two to watch, I'd rather watch Pretty in Pink.
Really?
Yeah.
No, I'm very much more of this. But I mean, this one, I think Pretty in Pink has dated quite badly.
This less so.
This less so, but it has still dated. Mm. Whereas The Breakfast Club, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, and Weird Science haven't really dated that badly at all. Weird Science, just because it's such a bizarre kind of comedy,
yeah,
that it's hard for that something like that to date. So, you know, apart from the fashions, you know, you see the way Robert Downey Jr. is dressed now, you're like, oh my god, and the haircuts. Whereas The Breakfast Club is obviously in an isolated place, so it's very hard for something like that to date.
And the clothes that they wear as well in The Breakfast Club aren't
to an extent.
They're not really that 80s. It's only when they make her
Molly over. Ringwald, I guess, is... No, but even then, she's just, you know, sort of trying to be kitchen fashionable with what she wears. So, yeah, it's not really that out of date, I guess.
Apart from when the... whatever his name is comes in and his suit is terribly 80s.
Yeah, I think he's got the sort of big collar going on his shirt as well, the black shirt he's got. So, no, those three, I think, date quite well, whereas these two and the first one we talked about, 16 Candles, I think, have dated.
Oh my God, I forgot we talked about 16 Candles.
Yeah. Well, back when we began.
Oh,
and this is where we end, because this is the last of the teenage bromance slash comedy slash dramas. After this, he went on to do... Well, actually, it was this year. And into the next year, he did Planes, Trains and Automobiles with Steve Martin and John Candy. And also, the exact same year as that, I believe, he did She's Having a Baby.
When did he do
Which was the 20-somethings. Yeah, with Kevin Bacon.
Oh, Kevin Bacon.
Did you know... Actually, have you seen both of those films?
No.
You've not seen Planes, Trains and Automobiles?
What was the other one you said?
She's Having a Baby.
I've not seen She's Having a Baby.
You know Kevin Smith did Jersey Girl?
Yes.
That was basically his homage to that. It was like... And you've seen Jack and Sarah with Richard E. Grant?
Yes.
That sort of thing. It's very good.
No.
But Kevin Bacon makes a cameo at the beginning of Planes, Trains and Automobiles as his character, and he races for a taxi against Steve Martin.
Who wins?
Kevin Bacon.
Of course he does, because he's got that athletic build.
Because Steve Martin trips over John Candy's trunk. But that's going into the future.
Yeah.
So out of all six,
yeah,
what is your favourite? Do you have a favourite? And are there any that you don't like anymore?
Okay, I didn't particularly like 16 Candles, although I'm sure when I listen back to this podcast, I'll be like, oh, I love 16 Candles. It was amazing. Such an amazing film.
But... Yeah, I don't. It's the one I don't like out of all of them. Pretty in Pink, I can only stomach because Annie Potts is in it.
I like Pretty in Pink because it's great, and it's got James Spader in it. And there aren't enough films with James Spader in, and there should be more. So, yes. I think probably Ferris Bueller or Breakfast Club. Ferris Bueller. Ferris Bueller is the one I could watch over and over and over and over and over again.
Yeah. I think for most people it's between those two. With the exception of Ben, actually, because I think Ben is just a huge Weird Science fan. Mm. And can't blame him, because it is hilarious. Mm.
There's nothing like taking like a toilet roll and some electrical tape into a bathroom and making a woman.
I think I have to give the prize to Breakfast Club purely for the fact that that's the only one that I have on Blu-ray at the moment.
Oh, okay, well, that tells you.
Yeah. Mm. Well, that is an hour and a half of talking about six John Hughes films. It's been a joy. Who knows what subject we will pick on next? But I can assure listeners, for anyone paying attention and who keep emailing me about it, all two of them, wondering where the Twilight podcast is, it's coming.
It's coming. I'm really sorry. I'm really sorry. I've been out of the country. It's going to happen.
But yes, thank you to Ben. Thank you to Laura. Thank you to Shane, twice over, and yourself, Suzanne, for talking about these John Hughes films. And we'll be back for more soon.
Bye.